From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. UCSF School of Medicine Professor Robert Lustig joins us in the next Forum Hour. Hundreds of thousands of people viewed his May 26, 2009 video on the toxicity of sugar, and he and his controversial views on the health dangers of sugar were recently featured in the New York Times Sunday magazine. We'll find out all about why Dr. Lustig believes the bitter truth about sugar is that it's a major cause behind a whole range of serious medical problems. Join us for Forum next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum program. According to the American Heart Association, too much of any kind of sugar is a key factor in diabetes, strokes, and heart disease, in a condition known as metabolic syndrome, in which cells actively ignore the action of hormone insulin and cause insulin resistance, makes more likely obesity, diabetes 2, and cancer, and 50 million adult Americans, or 35% of the population, suffer from it. That statistic is also according to the American Heart Association. Robert Lustig, UCSF professor of medicine and childhood obesity expert, sees sugar as the major culprit behind metabolic syndrome and also as a root cause to the serious escalation in the number of cases of obesity, diabetes, heart disease, hypertension, and possibly even cancer. On May 26th of 2009, Robert Lustig gave a 90-minute video lecture called Sugar, the Bitter Truth that went viral and was seen by hundreds of thousands of people on YouTube. He was recently featured in a New York Times Sunday Magazine cover piece, and joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. And yes, call me Michael, Rob, because this is the fourth time on the program. You asked me before we went on the air.
Thank you so much.
Glad to have you here, and let's get right into it. It's toxic. It's evil, sugar.
Well, here's the question. Is it just empty calories, or is it more? Up till now, the entire discussion over the obesity epidemic is we eat too much, we exercise too little. And for sure we do. I'm not arguing that point. There's plenty of data to support that. The question is that really what's going on? Did our behaviors really change? It's going on all over the world. This is a pandemic. They're doing bariatric surgery at Tokyo Children's. Okay, we never called them gluttons and sloths. I mean, they're beating the pants off us. This is going on through the entire Pacific Rim. It's going on all around the world. I just came back from Malaysia. It's the incidence of diabetes in Malaysia is the highest of any place in the world.
One of the most fascinating things I saw in that article in the New York Times was the Inuits up in the Arctic who were not having a Western diet. Now that they do have a Western diet, you see all these things just going way sky high.
Absolutely. Anybody who adopts our diet gets this problem. And that's what we've got worldwide. And everyone's adopted our diet because, number one, our diet is cheap. Number two, it's transportable. And number three, it tastes good.
But everybody's getting more wise about food, aren't they? Supposedly,
no.
Michael Pollan and all these crusaders and saviors.
Let's put it this way. There are some people who are getting wiser about food. But if you look at the general, middle of the road median in America and also around the world, I would venture to say that that wasn't the case.
Or maybe not wiser about high fructose corn syrup, as you would put it, perhaps.
Well, the bottom line is it's in everything. And the question is, why is it in everything? Why is it the first ingredient in barbecue sauce? Why is it the first ingredient in ketchup? I'll tell you why. It's very simple. We have four tastes on our tongue. We have sweet, we have salty, we have sour, and we have bitter. Sugar covers up all of them. For salty, I mean, look at Chex Mix. For sour, look at sweet and sour pork as an example. For bitter, milk chocolate. I mean, chocolate is bitter, but, you know, milk chocolate is not. Bottom line, and you might have to bleep this out, but you can make dog poop taste good with enough sugar. And in fact, that's what the food industry has done.
Some instances that may indeed be the case. Well, in fact, the analogy often comes down to sugar and all the sugar substance that is so pervasive and ubiquitous is sort of like alcohol and cigarettes. And you take pretty much a similar stand. And we'll talk about that in the course of this hour.
Mm-hmm.
But those who are critics say not enough really incontrovertible evidence. Yes, there's been stuff with rats. There's been stuff with mice. But we really don't know beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Okay. Let's talk science, because to be honest with you, I'm only about science. You know, everybody wants to make me out to be a zealot, you know, sort of a visceral response without the science. I didn't come to this, you know, sort of with an agenda. I came to this through the science. And I've been doing work on this for 15 years. And this is where the data has led me. So I've had a very good opportunity to review all of the science, some of which I generated, a lot of which I didn't, but other people did. And so you have to basically look at each piece skeptically and say, does this work? Does this not? Mr. Taubes did that in his article and ultimately came to the same conclusions I did.
Oh, he was on your side.
Well, he was. And, you know, he's his own man. Believe me,
he
is his own man.
In the New York Times Magazine.
Yes. All right. So here, let's talk science. There are different levels of science, and they contribute different levels of understanding. First, we have epidemiology. Okay. Now, epidemiology never proves anything because it's something's associated with something else. Correlation does not prove causation. And I am the first person to admit that. And I say this to our residents and fellows every single day down at UCSF. Correlation does not mean causation. But the correlation with respect to the sugar rise in terms of our diet and the epidemic of both obesity and diabetes worldwide is almost congruent. Almost congruent. You can actually see this going on a website where you can see the change, the secular trend change in both of these. We are actually evaluating this country by country right now.
It's funny, when you started talking about science, I thought you were going to get into liver stuff and insulin resistance. And
well, we are.
Okay.
We are. So then comes the next level, okay, which is the mechanistic questions. Now, mechanistic questions are where you do something and you then see an outcome. And so we have animal studies and we have human studies. And those animal studies are very clear in terms of what's going on. If you want to do diet-induced obesity, people say, you put the rat on a high-fat diet. Garbage. Here's why. You can't get a rat to eat a high-fat diet unless you add 20% sucrose to the diet. Basically, what you're doing is you're giving them cookie dough. But if you give them lard, they won't eat it. They actually lose weight on that because that's the Atkins diet for them. It's not palatable. They don't like it, and they actually lose weight, and their metabolic parameters improve. The only way to get an animal, rat, monkey, or any other animal for that matter, to eat a high-fat diet is to lace the fat with sucrose. So the question is, which is doing the damage, the fat or the sucrose in that case? And the answer is both.
But do we really know how much dosage, for example? We don't really do.
No, we don't know the dose because it's not been looked at in a codified fashion. And we're going to talk about why I think I have a sense of where that threshold might be.
Why not the clinical trials? I mean,
well, because they haven't been done.
They should be.
They should be, absolutely. So then we have the mechanistic studies in humans. Now, the problem with doing mechanistic studies in humans is this is not an acute phenomenon. This is a chronic phenomenon. This takes a long time. This takes years to be able to see. Okay, this, as Mr. Taubes put it in his article, it's not one meal that does it. It's 1,000 meals that does this. So how do you do a study in America where the food supply is what it is and be able to do this in a rational fashion? You can only do this in acute sort of 2-week or 4-week studies. The best study was done here at UC Davis by Kim Stanhope and Peter Havel, and they added an extra 1,000 calories per day of fructose versus glucose on top of an already eucaloric diet, and they saw all of these effects.
These ones that did about 40 meals roughly as opposed to 1,000, which some are saying need
That's
to be
right.
done. Yeah, because I was reading a blog That's recently. Right. You may know this guy, Alan Aragon, where he's one of your critics, and he says
–
he says, well, you know, Lustig makes some good points. He gives you props and everything. He says, but he's an alarmist. And a lot of it has to do with dosage and context. But a lot of it also has to do with, I guess, what his concern is, no data on blame for carbs. Where does carbs fit in here?
Okay. So let me back up and just finish the science, and then let's talk about that critique, because I think it's a very important critique. And it has a nugget of truth, but there's an answer for it. So we have the mechanistic studies that tell us what goes on when you overdose somebody on fructose. Everyone says if you're glycogen depleted, fructose goes to glycogen, and that's absolutely true. The problem is no one's glycogen depleted, so that's sort of a non-issue. That's a moot point. The one piece of data that we do not yet have is what happens if you restrict fructose. And the problem is you can't do it because the entire food supply has basically been tainted. So how are you going to be able to get somebody to go fructose-free for any length of time? Well, we're about to do it.
You're going to do it in Walnut Creek?
We are going to do – well, we're doing it in a pediatric study at UCSF as we speak that we have NIH money for. And we're going to do it on a city level. We're going to do it in the city of Martinez this coming year. The kickoff for this is on May 7th. It's called Change the Food, Change the Future.
Oh, that's in Walnut Creek.
It's going to be in Concord at Mount Diablo High School on Saturday, May 7th. And all of your listeners are welcome to come if they can get a ticket. It's pretty close to sold out.
A hot ticket. You're not going to have cotton candy there.
I don't think we're going to have cotton candy. But the point is that the mayor, Rob Schroeder, the school board, Sodexo, who supplies the food for the schools, everyone has gotten on board, and the city of Martinez is going sugar-free for a year. And we're going to actually look at what happens. We're going to have these data.
Talking to Robert Lustig, by the way, who's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health, the WATCH program at UCSF Medical Center. We're going to talk about carbs in a moment, but I want to just remind you that we do have our website back in operation. You can send a question or comment to us by simply going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or you can send us an email, forum@kqed.org, or post something on our Facebook page, which is simply facebook.com/kqedforum. So
I'd be happy to get back to Aragon if you want.
Yeah, well, I'm interested
it's a big issue.
More in the carbs and how intake of carbs affects all of this. I mean, to some extent, you've laid out a dictum here. Maybe dictum is the wrong word, but in a sense it is. You know, the idea that you should avoid sugar, any kind of sugar.
Well, added sugar.
Yeah.
I want to make that clear.
But, you know, if I eat white rice or if I'm eating carbs, I'm getting essentially the same kind of thing.
No, you're not.
Okay.
Completely
That's
not.
What people think,
oh,
right?
Oh, no. So let's set the table here. Let's do some definitions. What's what? Okay, there's something called starch. Bread, rice, pasta, potatoes. That's glucose. Glucose is necessary. Glucose is the energy of life. Glucose is so important that if you don't take it in, your body makes it anyway out of what you've eaten. It turns protein to glucose. It'll turn fat to glucose because you have to have a blood sugar because it runs the rest of your body. Every organ in your body runs on glucose, and every organism on the face of the earth runs on glucose. Glucose is important, and starch has it. Then you have this other thing over here called fructose. Fructose is the sweet part of sugar, and it only occurs in sugar. That is white sugar, table sugar, cane sugar, beet sugar, or honey, or maple syrup, or agave nectar, or any other caloric sweetener that you can imagine, because the fructose is the sweet part of sugar. Glucose isn't very sweet. You ever see anybody running around chugging Karo syrup? That's glucose. That's not very interesting. Okay, the good part, the thing that makes us want sugar, is the sweet part, which is fructose. And fructose is not glucose. And that's the point, because fructose is not glucose. But when you consume sugar, high fructose corn syrup, sucrose, agave nectar, any of those, you're getting both. You're getting glucose and fructose. You're never getting either or. You're always getting both. And that's why sugar's a problem. If you just consume glucose, what your liver – first of all, most of it would go to the rest of your body. Very little of it would go to your liver. And so your liver would be able to handle the onslaught. And it does. It raises your insulin. The insulin shunts that glucose to adipocytes, to fat. And so, yes, you would gain weight. And so glucose can make you gain weight. No argument there. In fact, that was how I got into this field in the first place, by looking at the insulin effect on glucose driving weight gain. However, that's not what fructose does. What fructose does is it goes to the liver specifically. And the liver, because it's dealing with the glucose that came in the sugar, it's going to glycogen, which is liver starch. That means that the fructose can't go to glycogen because the glycogen's all filled up. So it only has one way to go, and that's fat. And that's what the liver does to fructose when you are glycogen replete, when you are isocaloric, when you are not starved, fructose becomes fat. And when fructose becomes fat, it gums up the liver's working. And when it does that, you get something called hepatic insulin resistance. And when you do that, then you're going to end up driving insulin levels way high. You're going to shunt more sugar to fat. Plus, work that I've done shows that insulin blocks leptin signaling at the level of the brain, which causes the brain to think it's starved. It also blocks leptin's effects on the reward center of the brain so that you want more. And so now what you have is a vicious cycle of consumption and disease, all generated by the fructose. If that weren't enough, there's even a third way that fructose acts that's different from glucose. Diabetics know about this. It's called hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C is what we measure in the blood to determine what your blood sugar control has been like. The higher it is, the worse off you are, because the sooner you're going to end up getting kidney disease, nervous system disease, eye disease.
Hypertension, strokes.
Absolutely. All correct. This happens because glucose can bind to proteins without an enzyme. And the higher the glucose, the more it happens. Well, fructose does it 7 times faster. And it has been shown both in animal studies and now in human studies that you can find that fructose binding to proteins way faster, not just in diabetics, but in everybody. So it's driving all of the phenomena that cause aging as well. So
not only that, but I was just thinking about that UCLA study that separated fructose and glucose with respect to tumors.
Yes.
And what you see is fructose having more of an effect, like with pancreatic cancer.
That's right. And Mr. Taubes talked with the head of Memorial Sloan Kettering and somebody at NCI in that. And they are very concerned about what fructose might be doing in terms of cancer promotion. From two sites, that is the fructose being taken up as a preferential source for energy, and also by generating a high insulin, and the insulin drives cell division, which can make tumor promotion worse. So there is no advantage to consuming this stuff.
Let's pause there for a moment, because there are many, of course, who are sympathetic with you, and I mean, you have your critics, obviously, but who say, boy, I'm with him on this, and he's convinced me, and the science is there, et cetera, et cetera.
The science is there.
But
then
they'll say
it's not, it is.
But then they'll say to you, why move this into public policy? Why start taxing sugar? And why start saying to people, you know, kids, you can't go into convenience stores and buy sugar products at a certain time? And I mean, all those things have come up in your video and in your in the article that was done about you in the New York Times. And they say incursion on personal freedom and so forth.
Absolutely. This is a huge issue. So let's take this apart. We have substances that are toxic but not abused. Vitamin A, vitamin D, iron. Okay, these are things we need, but in high dose, they can actually hurt you. But they're not abused. There's no reason to abuse them. We don't have to regulate them. We then have substances that are abused but not toxic. For instance, caffeine. Nicotine. You can go out to the drugstore and get Nicorette gum without a prescription. Nobody would want to. Okay, but you could do it. It's abused but not toxic. The tars in the cigarettes are what's toxic. And the nicotine, of course, is what gets you hooked. But we don't regulate that either. However, the things that are both toxic and abused at the same time, and let's list them, cocaine, amphetamine, ethanol, heroin, morphine, okay, those things, because they're both toxic and abused, you generate a vicious cycle of consumption and disease. And that costs society money, and it costs society culture. Those we regulate because we have to be kept from ourselves. We have an entire agency in Washington that's supposed to keep us from ourselves, called the BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, because they know that these substances are a problem.
Ethanol. Well, I think just for the fact that people may not be aware of, I think the cost right now of cardiovascular disease and diabetes to $400 billion a year.
Absolutely.
Estimated cost.
Yeah. Absolutely. We are – it's often been said we wouldn't need healthcare reform if we had obesity reform. So here's President Obama's Healthcare Reform Act. And he says that we're going to be able to pay for this because – you know, we're going to be putting 32 million sick people on the rolls, and we're going to be able to pay for this because we're going to now get people into preventative services earlier. Garbage. And here's why. Because if their risk for cardiovascular disease, their risk for obesity, their risk for stroke, their risk for dementia, their risk for cancer is just going up because the food industry continues to apply sugar because there's no break on that, because fructose is on the generally regarded as safe list at the FDA. So any food company can put any amount of sugar in any food they want to surreptitiously without even telling us, and they don't even have to label it properly. As long as that continues to be true, how do you think we're going to be able to keep people out of the emergency rooms? Not possible. So how are we going to ultimately fix this? This is ultimately going to require a governmental intervention. So you say to me, wait a second, this is personal. This is a personal responsibility issue. Everybody gets to decide what goes into their
mouths. And people get very nervous when they hear government intervention. It sounds bureaucratic. It sounds personal life.
The nanny state and all that other
stuff. That's right.
Yeah, but we do that for everything already. Okay, we do that for alcohol. Okay, I mean, limitation of access. Seatbelts are a perfect example. They are a great example. Okay, so where did seatbelts start, Michael?
When did seatbelts start?
Where? This is the best example.
I think
yet.
It was Mothers Against Drunk Driving. At least the big force behind seatbelts.
Well, no. It started in Australia. Started in Australia in the 1940s and 50s. Okay, now did Australia know that seatbelts would save lives when they instituted it? No, they just thought this was a good thing to do, a good public health thing to do, and they did. And sure enough, seatbelts saved lives in Australia. The big three, now the big two.
And motorcycle drivers have to wear helmets?
Yeah.
And on we go.
It's all the same. And on we go.
Nanny state. Yeah.
Absolutely. Nanny state. Okay. Big three had to be dragged kicking and screaming to get seatbelts, kept seatbelts out of cars until 1979, when the federal government had a mandate that all new cars built in America had to have seatbelts. Did they save lives? Nope. How come? Because there was no mandate to wear them. It took Mothers Against Drunk Driving in the late 80s petitioning each state house across the country to finally get seatbelt laws for every single state. So today, there's a federal mandate that cars have to have seatbelts, but it's a state mandate that you have to wear them. And now do seatbelts save lives? You bet they do.
So this is
an example.
Talking to Robert Lustig, he is professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the Weight Assessment for Teen and Child Health. That's the WATCH program at University of California, San Francisco Medical Center. And as I said, Rob Lustig has, kicked up quite a hornet's nest here. A lot of interest, a lot of fascination, and a lot of concern. And you may indeed want to communicate with us. If so, we welcome your we welcome your emails and your web postings at this point, as well as your Facebook postings. We are currently having some problems with our phone. So feel free to question or comment or to bring your questions or comments forward by email forum@kqed.org or on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, which is simply facebook.com/kqedforum. We're coming up on a break, and so you're talking about, more government regulation, bottom line, aren't you?
Well, I'm worried about the fact that we'll need it for all the reasons we talked about. Now, the question is, how do you make that happen? There are two issues. One is the one I brought up before, the toxic abused issue. But then there's the other question of what we call externalities. And I've been working with my colleagues Claire Brindis and Laura Schmidt at the Institute for Health Policy Studies at UCSF on this exact question. If you smoke and you drink, it affects me. The question is, how does your obesity affect me? And the answer is, well,
hold that thought. That's a tease. How does your obesity affect Rob Lustig or any of the rest of us? We'll find that out when we come back, and we'll go to your emails and your postings, and we'll bring you into the conversation as best we can. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest is Robert Lustig, and we're talking to him about things that matter, like obesity and diabetes and heart disease and strokes and cancer, which he sees very connected to sugar and specifically fructose. He became an internet video sensation when he spoke about the evils of sugar in a post that went viral on YouTube, and he was recently featured in a New York Times Magazine cover story, "Is Sugar Toxic?" He's here to talk to us about the role of sugar in so many diseases, and he's professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and director of the WATCH program at UCSF Medical Center. So I want to go to your emails, and by the way, having some phone problems, but you can join us on our with questions or comments by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or visiting our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/kqedforum, and we're going to go to your comments and questions As you can imagine, a lot of them coming in here. But first, I wanted to find out what Rob Lustig had to say about why someone else's obesity affects you, Rob Lustig.
Right. So externalities is what public health is all about. When something you do affects me, that's when public health gets moving. That's when government starts intervening. So for smoking and drinking, it's obvious. Okay, secondhand smoke, that's what basically tilted the laws.
Your colleague Stan Glantz changed the whole landscape.
Absolutely. And to his credit. For drinking, obviously, drunk driving, accidents, these are things that I can't control when you drink and, you put me at risk. These are the things that ultimately lead to public health changes. So what's the externality in obesity? $274 million extra in jet fuel to carry the obese around? Not very exciting. Okay. You can't, fit in your seat on the plane? Not so exciting. How about the boat that sunk in Plattsburgh, New York, crossing Lake Champlain because it was sanctioned for 140 people, not 140 obese people? Not exciting.
But you're assuming that obesity is related entirely or exclusively in many ways to fructose, which probably I would concede, but also there are fat cells, there's genetics involved in obesity. There are so many things in addition to diet.
Sure, Michael, there are many ways to obesity. Okay, fructose is not the way to obesity, is a way to obesity. That's what people talk about. They're talking all about the refined carbs. Yes, refined carbs drive insulin. Insulin drives weight gain. There are lots of ways to get there. You can be fructose-free and still become obese. But the thing is that fructose is the single item that takes you from obesity to metabolic syndrome. And metabolic syndrome is where all the money goes in terms of comorbidity.
Talk a little bit about metabolic syndrome because it is the big game changer for you. And what we're talking about essentially are cells that are actively ignoring action of hormone insulin, insulin resistant essentially.
Right. So basically the question is, how does fructose generate this thing called insulin resistance? In fact, it's not just fructose. There are four foodstuffs that are on the table here. Fructose happens to be the big kahuna. Fructose happens to be the one that people abuse. But there are four. One is fructose. The other one is ethanol. We can talk about that at great length. The third one is branched chain amino acids. Now, people are not going to understand that, but basically low quality protein in sort of, processed hamburger meat. And the fourth one is trans fats. Now, we're getting rid of trans fats.
We are.
Okay. The question is, what do those four foodstuffs have in common that's different from, say, other things? And there are two things that these four foodstuffs have in common. Number one, they're not insulin regulated and there's no pop-off valve. Number two, they go straight to the mitochondria. The mitochondria is that portion of your cell which actually burns the energy. And they can't basically deal with the onslaught of these four foodstuffs coming at them. They can't turn the cycle in the mitochondria fast enough to be able to do anything about it. This generates reactive oxygen species, which causes cell aging and ultimately contributes to diabetes. And it also causes the buildup of liver fat. And that drives the liver to basically not be able to do its job. That makes the pancreas make more insulin. And so the cycle gets worse. So these four foodstuffs do something that's very different from the rest of our diet, and they've all been implicated in metabolic syndrome. Of those, the big kahuna, the one that the kids are exposed to, because they're not exposed to alcohol, is
fructose. Keep it out of children's hospitals, etc.
Well, keep it out of kids entirely.
And if you're a parent,
Look at baby food. Okay. I'm not going to mention names, but if you look at the second and third stages of baby foods, it's half sugar.
You don't have to mention names because the names are well known to people who have babies. And we've got a rush of questions here, so let's get through as many as we can.
Sure.
Here's Teresa, who begins by saying, I wondered if Dr. Lustig could speak to risk of diabetes for vegans and near vegans. I'm ovo-vegan myself and know we enjoy reduced risk of cardiovascular disease and obesity, but since I converted a couple years ago and made fruit my fast food, I've been experiencing postprandial blood sugar crashes, hypoglycemia, that are sometimes quite severe.
Okay. Well, those are two different issues. The hypoglycemia can happen anytime you get a high insulin response and then a quick fall. And the more insulin sensitive you are, the more likely that hypoglycemia will occur. Usually, when you consume whole fruit, this is not a problem. And the reason is because the fiber in the fruit reduces the rate of absorption from the gut into the bloodstream, thus giving your liver a chance to catch up. It reduces the rate of flux. Fiber is good. Fiber is an essential nutrient. The USDA does not call it such. It should be, and it needs to be. There are reasons why the USDA does not allow fiber to be an essential nutrient, because if it was, then all the food we've been shipping all over the world basically is malnourished food because it's fiberless food. Fast food is fiberless food because you can't freeze fiber. Prove it to you. Take an orange, put it in your freezer, leave it there overnight, take it out next morning, thaw it, try to eat it, see what you get. Turns to mush because the ice crystals damage the cell wall. Food industry knows this. So squeeze it, freeze it, lasts forever. So eat your fruit, don't drink it. That's one of our mantras for the clinic. Another one is, when God made the poison, he packaged it with the antidote. Wherever there's fructose in nature, there's way more fiber. It's almost a linear correlation between fructose and fiber. The only exception is grapes and honey. For grapes, I don't know, but for honey, they're guarded by bees. So bottom line, God made sugar hard to get. Man made sugar easy to get.
When you're talking about not drinking, I remember that story about that those Mexican kids. I think it was the last time you were on Forum you told that story mm-hmm. about their drinking orange juice.
Absolutely.
And just huge amounts of orange juice.
Right.
Which kind of ties in with this next question. I wouldn't believe the number of questions. Or maybe you would. How addictive is sugar?
Ah, really good question. So, again, it's a question of the science. We have animal studies and we have human studies. The human studies are tough, to say the least, because there's no baseline. Everyone's exposed. So they're very hard to do. We do have animal studies that are very clear. The answer there, Bart Hobel at Princeton University, along with Nicole Avena, who's now at the University of Florida Gainesville, has done the yeoman's job. Kent Berridge, also at the University of Michigan. There's a tremendous amount of data. In order to be an addictive substance, the American Psychological Association says you have to satisfy four criteria: binging, craving, withdrawal, and cross-sensitization with other drugs of abuse, meaning if you're exposed to one drug, then you expose to another drug, you get a heightened physiologic response from the second drug. Sugar does them all. Without question, sugar does them all. Now, in humans, what do you have to look at? The data are it's a little bit different. There's the DSM-5 criteria. So the two physiologic criteria are tolerance and withdrawal. And I would point everyone, if you need to understand this, to Morgan Spurlock's Supersize Me. On day 18 of his sojourn of eating McDonald's every day for a month, he describes withdrawal. He says he's sitting on his girlfriend's couch. You know, remember, she was a vegan chef, so he was previously unexposed. This is 18 days into his ordeal, and he's talking to the camera. He says, you know, I was feeling really lousy. I was feeling crappy. I was feeling like shit. Started eating. Now I feel great. I feel so great, it's crazy. He just described withdrawal. In addition, seeking and forgetting about other things in your life for looking for food. And we have sugar addicts in our clinic, and all you have to do is come to our clinic and see for yourself.
Nice.
So I'll put our science up against this. Dr. Andrea Garber and I at UCSF just wrote a paper called Is Fast Food Addictive?, which will be in Current Drug Abuse Reviews later this year.
There's a related posting on the web from Kathy who says, I am absolutely addicted to sugar and have been all my life. I'm a 36-year-old woman with no cancer or diabetes history in our family. I also have a young daughter. How much damage have I potentially done, or any person in my position, like quitting smoking and lungs? Can the effect be reversed? Additionally, like other drugs, can you pass a higher likelihood of addiction to your children?
You know, we don't know the answer to that. Those studies haven't been done. I can only venture a guess, and it's purely a guess. I think that there's probably a certain modicum of damage that is already done, but you can absolutely stop it and you can probably reverse some of it, because those changes in proteins that fructose binds to, those can ultimately be cleared to some extent. So I think the answer is that some of it is reversible.
Before I get to more questions from our listeners, a question that that comes up sometimes when people are critical of the link of obesity. I mean, we already said that there are many paths to obesity, and certainly, mm-hmm. You often hear the argument it's more caloric intake overall than it is, for example, something like sugar or fructose being a major factor.
Well, look, like I said when we started the hour, we're all eating more. I'm not arguing that, okay? Adult men are eating 187 calories a day more than 25 years ago. Adult females, 335 calories a day more than 25 years ago.
And we're also more sedentary than we've ever been.
Absolutely. So I did this once for you before. Let's do it again for your viewers. Let's take
listeners.
Listeners. Let's take you, Michael, okay? You are nice and thin. You eat 2,000 calories a day. You burn 2,000 calories a day. You feel good. No problem. Normal day. Are you going to gain weight, lose weight, or stay the same?
I pretty much stay the same.
Stay the same because you burn what you eat, nothing to store.
Yeah.
No problem. Good. Okay, now let's do a little experiment. I'm going to put an IV in your arm, tape it down, and every time you reach for food, I'm going to pump you full of extra insulin you didn't want or need. Insulin's the energy storage hormone. That's its job. It's going to shunt sugar to fat. That's what it does. So this is the new Michael Krasny. You wake up in the morning, you start out the day eating 2,000 calories just like before, but now, because of the excess insulin I'm pumping you full of, 500 of those 2,000 calories, whoosh, straight to fat right off the top, like what the IRS does to your paycheck, right off the top. Gone before you have a chance to spend it, gone before you had a chance to burn it. You now weigh a seventh of a pound more because 500 calories are in your fat and you had nothing to do with it. So if you stood on the scale, you would weigh more. Now, you ate 2,000, but you lost 500 to your fat. How many calories do you have left to burn? 1,500. Except your body wants to burn 2,000 because that's where it feels good. And how many calories you burn and how good you feel are synonymous. They are the same thing. Energy expenditure and quality of life are synonymous. Things that make your energy expenditure go up make you feel good, like ephedrine, it's off the market, exercise, caffeine for 2 hours. Things that make your energy expenditure go down, like hypothyroidism, starvation, make you feel lousy. You now only have 1,500 calories. Your body wants 2,000. How do you feel? You feel lousy. It's starvation. Your brain thinks you're starving. So in this world of free – so are you going to be gluttony? I mean, you're going to be slothy, sit on the couch, don't want to do anything, maybe play video games? Sound familiar? So in the world of free access to food, what are you going to do? Eat back the 500. Now you're eating 2,500 instead of 2,000. And you still don't feel great because I took another 100 whoosh, right off the top into your fat. So you go to a doctor, you go to a nutritionist, you say, "Doc, every time I stand on the scale, I weigh more. How come? How come I'm so fat?" And the doctor looks at your behaviors and says, "Hey, you're a glutton and a sloth. You eat too much, you exercise too little." And guess what? It's true. You are. But not because you chose to, not because you want to. It's because you have to. It's a biochemical drive set up by the high insulin I pumped you full of. So you ask me, okay, fine. Where'd the insulin come from now? The answer? The insulin resistance that was generated by the fructose.
Teresa writes, enjoying this topic, just threw out my son's leftover birthday cake. What about natural sugars like stevia? And another listener writes, artificial sweetener sucralose appears to be in more and more products. Please ask Dr. Lustig if there is any health problems associated with sucralose. So we've got natural sugars and we've got sort of artificial sugars being asked about.
Everybody wants the substitute. Everybody wants to know, okay, if I can have sugar, what can I have? Okay, how do I keep my diet sweet? To be honest with you, I don't know the answer. Okay, as far as I'm concerned, we need to de-sweeten the American palate. People from Europe come over here, get off the plane for the first time, eat our food and go, "Oh God, this is awful, this is so sweet." They're here 2 months, they can't tell and they've gained 25 pounds. So the question is there a rational approach to dietary non-nutritive sweeteners? Here's the problem in one idea. There's something called pharmacokinetics. That is, what your body does to a drug. Then there's something called pharmacodynamics, what the drug does to your body. For all the non-nutritive sweeteners, and we can list them all, we can go all the way from aspartame through azosulfame K, through Rabania or stevia, through sucralose, we have the pharmacokinetics because the FDA demanded them before they would approve them. So we know what your drug does, what your body does to those. We have zero information on what those do to your body. And there's a reason we have zero information, because the companies that make them don't want you to know, because it can't help them. So those studies haven't been done, and the NIH has not sponsored those
studies. Don't they need FDA approval and all that from these companies?
No. To get FDA approval, all you have to do is show safe and effective. Doesn't have to show what it does to your body. So the question is, do diet non-nutritive sweeteners have effects on your body that you don't know about?
The answer is we don't know.
We don't know. So it's very hard for me to make a recommendation. What I do know is that some of the companies that make these are now catching on to the fact that they need to do these. And so stay tuned. This is a work in progress.
Well, like you say, everybody's looking for a substitute. Here's Kim, who says some raw foodists get the majority of their calories from raw sweet fruit and are quite healthy over many years. What does Dr. Lustig think of this type of eating?
Well, raw sweet fruit, it's fine. I mean,
yeah,
it's because
the
fiber.
And so,
the fiber. As far as I'm concerned, as long as the fiber's there, as long as you eat it as nature intended, as it came out of the ground, and this is the Michael Pollan argument, okay? Don't eat food that your grandparents wouldn't recognize as food. Look, we have three different movements going on in this country about food. We have the slow food movement of Alice Waters, okay, which says, eat food for food's sake. You know, someone asked Alice Waters, what's your definition of fast food? Letting someone loosen a garden with a bottle of balsamic vinegar and saying, have at it. That's fast food. I love that. I think that's cute.
That's good.
Then there's Michael Pollan, who basically talks about the socio-political aspects of the food supply. What I'm talking about is the biochemistry of food, okay, and what it actually does to you. And that's different from the other two. I think we're all saying the same thing. We're just saying it in slightly different ways and to different audiences.
Well, from your biochemical and scientific standpoint, what about natural alternatives like agave or honey?
No. Well, agave is 75% fructose, so that's not a winner. And honey's 50-50, and so that's not a winner either. Now, agave, maple syrup, honey, they all have their own distinct flavor. They also cost more, so people tend to use less of them. So as far as I'm concerned, anytime you use less of something that's got fructose in it, that's a good thing. But I'm not going to tell you that you should go out and turn your entire diet over and put agave sweetener in everything you consume. That's probably not such a good idea.
The listener says, I hear what your guest is saying, but doesn't weight loss, not nutrition, come down to total calories? Or is it that all calories are not the same in terms of weight loss, sugar calories versus carbohydrate calories versus fat and protein calories?
They're not the same. They are absolutely not the same. You know, there. This is the myth that has been perpetuated in the American public's eye. A calorie is a calorie.
Who's perpetuating that myth?
Actually, the USDA. In fact, to his credit, I have been a very long-standing critic of Tom Vilsack, the commissioner of the Food and Drug of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. However, just 1 month ago, he came out and actually said the magic words, a calorie is not a calorie. A calorie burned is a calorie burned, but a calorie eaten is not a calorie eaten. It can be isocaloric, but not isometabolic. 100 calories of glucose and 100 calories of sucrose, where it's 50-50, are metabolized completely differently. We have good proteins and bad proteins. We have good fats and bad fats. Well, guess what? We have good carbohydrates and bad carbohydrates also. Bottom line, if you stick to a calorie as a calorie, you're screwed. That's what we've been doing for the last 30 years, and look where it's gotten us. Get off it.
Mark says, when people say they love sugar, the foods they talk about are usually combinations of sugar, fat, and flour. Can your guest comment on the health implications of these kinds of foods versus pure sugar?
Well, bottom line, the flour is glucose. The glucose is going to be metabolized by the liver to glycogen. That's going to take everything else, and it's going to force it through the fat pathway. So the bottom line is, the more carbohydrate plus fructose that you consume, the more it's going to end up as fat. We see this with the ethanol analogy. Fructose and ethanol are basically indistinguishable to the liver. This is work that I've done that shows that fructose and ethanol basically get metabolized exactly the same way. So here's the problem. We have red wine, which is good for you. We have hard spirits, which have been shown to improve your HDL as long as you keep it in moderation and keep it under the threshold of 50 grams per day. But then we have this thing called beer, and shochu, which has been shown to induce both insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. Now, they both have alcohol in it, yet one seems to help you and the other one seems to hurt you. Why? Because the one that hurts you has both glucose and ethanol. So when you drink ethanol straight and keep it under the threshold, it's probably a health benefit. When you consume glucose plus ethanol together, that's when you get into trouble. Well, the problem with sugar is you're always consuming the glucose and the fructose together. You never dissociate the two. So the glucose is the glucose, the fructose is the ethanol, and it hurts you. Now, There are some people out there who are saying, okay, let's use crystalline fructose as a sweetener. In other words, no glucose, just fructose. The problem with that is that our GI tract doesn't absorb it, and it actually makes you kind of sick to your stomach and causes a lot of GI difficulties and diarrhea. So I'm not sure that that's a good answer. Plus, what I know about fructose's metabolism and that whole glycation issue and the binding to the proteins does not make me feel very good about that.
Well, you may not feel good about this either. I should mention, by the way, you're getting a lot of questions about link between sugar and Alzheimer's, links between fructose and seizures. And these are things that obviously we're going to need a lot more research on.
Right.
But here's a
We don't have data on those yet to be able to make any sort of definitive statements.
Here's a listener who's critical. Anna writes, "Your guest, I believe, misleads the listener and makes some inaccurate statements. One, fat is not converted to glucose. Only a tiny part of fat, triglyceride molecule, is. Fatty acids are not. Two.
I didn't say it was.
Fructose ingested is also converted by the liver to glucose, not necessarily to fat. Three, this discussion, like so many, reduces complex issues into simple ones for public consumption, leaving out key bits of information, leaving the listener with a demonization of fructose. What about fruit? Overconsumption of sugar-rich foods, whether from sucrose or HFCS, leads to health problems by a myriad of pathways. I come across people who avoid fruit and now think Coke made from sucrose is healthy and that made from HFCS and people who think agave syrup is healthy. I agree with some of what your guest says, but also I'm getting annoyed because he is simplifying the issues to the point of misleading, leading to erroneous conclusions, adds to confusion."
Well, I think she's got a few erroneous conclusions about what I've said on several counts. Number one, I never said fat got turned to glucose. It doesn't. In fact, fat basically gets turned to LDL, and LDL then gets exported out of the liver. So I don't know where that came from. The second one was you want to help me out, Michael?
We'll go
because
back,
there were so many of them.
The email. Yeah,
there
were
so many of them. there's an answer for every one of these.
Mainly three. Fructose ingested is also converted by the liver to glucose, not necessarily to fat.
That's true. And in the glycogen-depleted state, so in other words, if you're an elite athlete and you've actually depleted your glycogen because you've been out on the gridiron for, say, 3 hours, then fructose takes a backdoor pathway through fructose 6-phosphate back to glycogen. That's absolutely true. And that's why the sports drink companies say they added high fructose corn syrup into sports drinks. Now, let's talk about sports drinks here for a second because it's major league abused.
Before you get to sports
kids.
Drinks, Gatorade and all those kinds of things,
as
we'll name them, she's saying you're demonizing and simplifying.
Well, I don't know if I'm simplifying. I think it's pretty darn complicated, and I'm trying to—
Or being reductive, maybe.
Well, I think there are some clear reductionistic similarities. You know, this idea of the mitochondria not being able to metabolize the excess energy that's brought to it because there's no pop-off valve. That's a very high concept. I met with Dr. Chris Newgard, who's head of the Obesity and Nutrition Research Center at Duke University, because he does the branched chain amino acid work. And we actually compared notes about 3 weeks ago, and it was almost semi-orgasmic on the floor of my office in terms of the understanding of how this works. Because he was looking for, he said, you know, it can't be just branched chain amino acids. That doesn't explain everything. So I showed him our fructose data, and he went, oh my God, yeah, now it makes sense. So I would pose to the listener that I'm not being reductive at all. I'm trying to be encompassing, you know, for all the things that are going on in our diet.
And sports drinks now.
Okay, so sports drinks. So there's no question that if you're glycogen depleted, fructose helps replete glycogen faster. I don't disagree with that. That's absolutely true. The question is, if you're not glycogen depleted, what happens? Then it goes to fat. So elite athletes can drink all the sports drinks they want. It's not a problem. But who's drinking the sports drinks? The fat kids, because it's cool. So let's go back and think about Gatorade, okay? And I can use Gatorade because this is the real deal. 1965, Dr. Robert Cade at the University of Florida, Gainesville, invents Gatorade. Okay? 1972, the Florida Gators beat the Auburn Tigers in the Sugar Bowl, which at that time was the equivalent of our national championship.
Does it make you wince when you say Sugar Bowl?
Yeah, it does, actually. Well, remember, Louisiana, the Bayou, they've got a lot of sugar cane down there. So bottom line, Gatorade made a big splash. Did you ever taste the original Gatorade?
Yeah.
Tasted awful.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay? And the reason was
because—
I never could
understand that, in fact.
It was glucose, sodium, potassium, and water. It was the same oral rehydration solution we give cholera victims in India and worked for the same reason. because you need the glucose for the sodium and potassium facilitated transport across the gut. So the glucose had to be there. Now, does fructose have to be there for that? No. So did the old Gatorade rehydrate effectively? Absolutely. Now, then Quaker Oats buys Gatorade, and then Pepsi buys Quaker Oats. And the question is, all right, what do we do with this stuff? How do we market this stuff? Two things. Hire Michael Jordan, and two, add high fructose corn syrup. So now it tastes good. Now the kids all want to drink it. Except the people who should be drinking it are the elite athletes on the gridiron, and the people who are drinking it are the fat kids in the schools. That's the problem.
Well, we're almost running out of time here, and Rick has an important question. I'm a UCSF cancer patient advocate. I understand that glucose, sugar, honey promote tumors. Please, can Dr. Lustig explain why dietitians at the Cancer Center and nationwide strongly advise against consumption of white foods like white rice, white flour, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, because of insulin. Insulin drives tumor promotion, tumor growth. I would refer the listener to Dr. Donald Abrams, who is the head of integrative health at the Osher Center and also professor of oncology at San Francisco General Hospital. And he gives a wonderful lecture, and I believe one of them is on YouTube, that talks specifically about this issue. Bottom line, insulin is good for you and it's bad for you. It's both. It's good for you because it keeps your blood sugar down, but it's bad for you because it causes cell division.
I should mention, by the way, Dr. Abrams has a book out. When are you going to get a book out?
I'm going to stay quiet on
that. With that video of yours, I think it is advisable. I'm sure there are many publishers who'd be interested. Listen, I think Kessler's book, which deals with a lot of the same issues, did pretty well.
Well, I'll be honest with you. There's no science in Kessler's book. I wasn't that happy with it. He basically says that the food industry took the food and made it irresistible. Well, yeah,
David Kessler, formerly of UCSF. I wish we had more time, but we're out of time. Rob Lustig, good to have you on. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you all, our listeners, for another Forum program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.